This is Cheryl McCoyd with the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. It's December 6, 2005. It's approximately 12 o'clock noon. We're preparing to interview Donna Jean Gillespie Graham. First of all, we'll have the other members state their names.
Doreen Howard.
Marilyn Coulter.
And Donna Jean, would you please state your name and spell your last name for the record?
Donna Jean Gillespie Graham, that's G-I-L-L-E-S-P-I-E hyphen G-R-A-H-A-M.
And Donna, are you, I'm sorry, I need your address also.
6496 West Dewey Road, Ovid, O-V-I-D, Michigan, 48866.
And are you married? Do you have children?
Yes, I am recently married, actually. I have a husband, Peter, and two stepsons, Christopher and Dominic, and my own daughter, Elissa.
And could you give us a little bit of your educational background?
I have an Associates of Business from Baker College. And at the time I got called to Fisher Body, I was working on my bachelor, but I haven't finished that up yet.
And speaking of Fisher Body, when were you hired in? Do you know what your seniority date is? And could you tell us a little bit about the very first day walking in the plant?
I have an adjusted seniority date of July 2nd, 1991, because I was at several other plants for brief periods before. I'm a GM gypsy kind of person. I came to Fisher Body in August of 1994. And I just remember it being very huge. But I was immediately adopted by Craig Johnson, our alternate benefits rep, or alternate
Workers' comp
rep. And he and I worked together for about 6 years to start off. So he started me off right and introduced me to everybody and still looks out for me now and then.
Do you remember your first job?
Yes, I was on the door line inserting side door glass. At one point we did front and back, and then when they moved the door line upstairs in the plant and went to taking the doors off to build up the door, and then after the door is completely built up and they put it on conveyor and goes back down and is refitted to the car. At that point in time, they broke it up into front glass and rear glass, and I was on front glass. So I did that for about probably 8 years altogether.
So you said you're a GM gypsy. Could you tell us a little bit about your GM life?
Yeah, I started in 81 over at Chassis plant on the C system. Right when the Grand Ams and stuff, I think it was in like the second or third model year, they were ramping up still for full production. And so they brought on actually, no, wait a minute, that's not where I started. That was in 84. I'm sorry. 81, I went over to Metal Fab and I loaded conveyors with raw crankshafts. They're just big chunks of semi-shaped steel, and you load them onto the mill, the conveyor, and they feed them into the mill and grind them down to certain specifications. And then on weekends when we worked overtime, I did gauging operations as they came off the mill, as the crankshafts came off the mill. That was in 84. I was a week short of getting 90 days in. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, okay, see ya. Then they called me back in 84. To chassis side, and that's what did I do over there? I did a lot of things. I did worked on instrument panels, connecting, making electrical connections, and worked on e-check. I installed speakers into the instrument panel, and then I ended up there. I was installing back seats, the cushions that get bolted down, and the seat belts. And that was then in 87. They said, see ya again. Mm-hmm. And I was off for about 7.5 years until I got called to Fisher Body. We call that the 7 years of famine at our house. Mm-hmm. I worked other jobs meantime, but they were all pretty menial. Sometimes I worked as many as 3 jobs trying to make ends meet, but it's not a GM job.
So, then you came in...
Marilyn Coulter.
I'm sorry. So then you came into Lansing Fisher Body.
Yes.
How did the people of Fisher Body differ from the other two facilities that you worked in?
Well, you know, it's odd, and I'll get in trouble for saying this because I got in trouble the last time I said this, and I had made the mistake of putting it in print. I never spoke to a committee person. A committee person never spoke to me while I was at either of the plants in 81 and 84. I didn't know who they were. And nobody ever said union meetings on such and such a day. Nobody. Immediately, the first thing when I came over to Fisher Body, I knew who the committee man was. I knew when the meetings were. It was a very different system. You were encouraged to attend meetings. And it was just, I guess maybe because it's so much bigger over at the other plant, it spread out more or something, but new hires were not really initiated as, I don't know how to say it politically correct. They weren't strongly encouraged to get involved, but to justify that a little bit, in between the interims, during that 7 years of famine, I got active politically. So when I came back, I had already been coached by some other UAW members to start getting involved because the union will help your candidates. So my first experience, I can't remember my first day in the plant, but I remember my first time I came over to this union hall.
And what was that like for you?
That was Marilyn.
Marilyn?
I came to the plant to ask if they would put a yard sign in the front of the, or it came to the hall to see if they would put a yard sign out for my candidate, who was at that time Damian Frazier, and he was running it against Dave Camp in the 4th Congressional District. And our receptionist at that time was Gail Gooselin. And as it happened, President Gary Bernath was not occupied, and she sent me up to see him. And I introduced myself, and he shook my hand, and the end result was he said, I'll take two. And he took, because he happened to live in our district, too, so he took one for his home and one for the union hall. And that was kind of the start of things for me as far as union activism goes.
Oh, that's cool.
A month or so later, I found myself actually out working on the campaign. This is before all the... new regulations on stuff. They out as an organizer, but in effect, I don't know if you can use this part, but they used to be able to send people out to work on campaigns, and I was in the plant maybe 6 weeks, and all of a sudden I was gone for 3 weeks. So it was kind of a strange beginning, but it was, turned out to be pretty fortuitous for me. I apparently made a good impression when the first words out of my mouth were, can I put a yard sign here?
And this?
Cheryl McQuaid. Donna Jean, do you remember what it was like having a child at home and having to go from plant to plant, and how hard was it on your family life?
The plants were all in Lansing. That was not, I was always very blessed in that my parents were able to step in, look after my daughter. No matter what shift I worked when I was at GM, the hard part was when I was off from GM and had to juggle 3 jobs and go to school full time and try to make ends meet. Those were the hard parts. But yeah, my parents were always there. If I had to work Saturdays, I usually was able to be home when she was home. A lot of times I volunteered to work night shifts so that I could be home during the daytime. But then, you know, during her teen years, when you have to pay a babysitter, you feel like you're paying somebody else to raise your kid for you. And that person may or may not raise your kid according to your own personal values. But because my parents were in there to fill in a lot, especially during her younger years, that took a lot of that guilt or burden off me. It was a real lifesaver. I, you know, as she got older, it and her personality was more and character were more well formed. It wasn't such an issue. But during those really young years, you want your kids to have the right values. And when you work afternoon shift, you don't see your family until Saturday and Sunday, and that's if you're not working on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. So you were laid off a number of times. What was it like being laid off?
It was horrible. It is like one day you have a job and everything's going well and you're working tons of overtime and you got money coming in, and suddenly they come up and say, you're going to be laid off in 2 days or 1 day or whatever. And that's it. They don't really sit you down and explain what your options are, what the process is. They just, you know, hand you a sheet of paper and expect you to figure it out. That's why when it came to the mass layoffs here at Fisher Body, I got planted myself in President Art Luna's office, and I said, look, you've got a lot of young, low seniority people who do not know, and they're scared to death, because I've been there and I've done that. I know exactly what their fears are, and we've got to help them. We've got to pave the way so that they know exactly what they're entitled to, exactly what their responsibilities are, and what benefits are available to them, and what other sources of help. That was probably one of the most, I think, personally, most valuable things I've done as a union activist, is to help our members get through those three waves of mass layoffs. As we went through successive waves, the members had more experience, they were more higher seniority, and they knew more or less what to expect because they'd been following along with the program, the layoff support system that we came up with. They'd been following that along. So it was less and less, but the first batch was real low seniority, scared young kids with young families.
You often say family. Did you find that, and you said that, like, when you came to the Mount Coulter, you said that, like, Craig took you under the wing. Did you have a work family within the plant?
Yeah, I think you bond, I think you build families or communities or whatever you want to call them wherever you go. We always used to joke, my last partner, Hector Rodriguez, and I, we always used to joke that we're really closer to each other and we know more as much about each other as our husbands and wives do. Mm-hmm. Because those cars keep going by and you've got to kill the monotony somehow, and so you know every detail of what whose kid is dating what and whether they're a no-good son of a gun or whether they really like them or, you know, honest to God, this is probably one of those off the records, but we discuss our bowel habits. Uh-huh. You know, go that far. Finally, we figured out that, well, we drink this, you know, like 3 quarts of water during the work week, but on the weekend we don't drink as much water. I mean, it gets really down to personal details. You find one thing that surprised me, I guess, is how many people are willing to talk about spiritual and religious issues. And that it kind of surprised you. Because people don't, as a rule, talk openly about that stuff. It's more personal, I don't know. But you're going to talk, the person you work with every day, assuming you get along reasonably well, you're going to know inside and out. They're going to know if they got a hangnail or an ingrown toenail or whatever going on. And there's a bond there that never goes away. I haven't worked with CJ Craig Johnson in 10 years, but we still got a hug and catch up quick, first thing we see each other.
Have you, Marilyn Hope Still, have you had any of those relationships that continued outside the plant walls?
Because we live quite far away from Lansing, I'd have to say no, although we do still keep in touch with Gary Bernath, but that's because he's out in our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. most of the union activities, we see a lot of people at other union activities that take place outside the union hall, outside the plant. Pete has been here longer. My husband, Pete Gillespie, he's been at Fisher Body much, much longer. He's got 27, going on 28 years. He has people he's known since he was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And yes, they're still friends, and they talk in the email and outside the plant. But I would have to say that most of the friendships, by the time you get home, you drive an hour to work, you drive an hour home, you put in 8 to 10 hours at work. By the time you get home, you've got to clean house, you've got to cook meals, you've got to do laundry, you've got to wash the dishes, you've got all these other things to do. I don't have any friends outside of the union, I don't think. We went out for dinner probably now 2 months ago with three other couples, and that was like, wow, that was fun. That was the first time we went to something that was just purely social. But we're both pretty committed unionists, and most of our weekend and evening activities flow around that. So I guess we'd have to get away from the union to see if those contacts continued.
You were at a couple other plants in the Lansing area. Mm-hmm. Explain some of the differences and similarities between the facilities that you were at.
First of all, the first plant I was in, it was kind of an isolated job. You weren't around many people. You were just two or three. You know, there wasn't team meetings. There wasn't a lot of interaction with people that weren't right in your immediate area, so that limited your contacts inside the plant to maybe half a dozen people plus your supervisor. Now, the second plant, because I moved around to so many different jobs, from the instrument panel line to the cushion line and all that stuff, then you got to meet more people. And as you went to the next group, you met a new group of people, but you kept contact, at least in passing, with the other folks that you met. And how all that compares with 602 at Fisher Body, you're always going to be closest to the people that are right next to you, I think.
Marilyn Coulter, Donna, how was it for you being a woman inside a factory environment?
Well, first time around in 81 at the fab plant, I have to admit coming to the conclusion that men will look at any woman, whether she's attractive or not, rather than look at another man. If you're the only woman there, everybody's going to look at you. Here, I didn't... At 652, I never made an effort to get involved. Nobody made an effort to draw me in, but I never made an effort either. So six and one, half a dozen together. Here, I never found it an issue. I was, I guess, fortunate in making that initial contact with Gary Bernath, and he kind of fast-tracked me. Mm-hmm. Which did cause some resentment from my peers that had worked longer, worked harder, been involved longer initially. But I think that after a couple of years, they pretty much accepted that I'd proved myself, and that seemed to go away. And I was here longer by that time.
That, and you proved yourself, and I'm just kind of moving forward. Move forward, and you were fast-tracked, but you kind of also proved yourself and shown your support because you were now the recording secretary of this local union, and you have done so for two terms, correct?
Which this is my third term.
Your third term. Mm-hmm. So you're going into your third term, each term being 9 years.
No, each term being
three years. I mean, a total of nine years.
A total of 9 years, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, and that happened after Gary Bernath had moved to the International. I always tell him about that. Yeah, you got help me get started here and here and here, but I got elected on my own, you know. Actually, I didn't. I'm one of the very few officers of this local who has never been elected. Nobody's ever actually cast a vote for me because I ran unopposed three times. So, no, I wasn't elected. It was just default. Nobody else wanted the job. And I tell them, no, this job sucks so bad, nobody wants it. However, Gary Bernath did help me get started as a substitute editor for the local union weekly publication. And then when the editor got a full-time job doing something else, I took over as full-time editor. Left for a little while over, I guess, what you might call editorial conflicts. And now I'm back. Well, and I've been back for 3 years now.
Being the editor of the paper, what does that entail? What have been some of the most exciting things that you've covered?
Some of the most exciting things we cover never get into the newsletter. As the editor, it's not... I don't write articles for the paper. I could, but I don't, because that's not what the editor's job is. The editor's job is to make everybody else make sense. You know, somebody turns in an article to me on whatever subject, be it community services or union label or whatever, and they're not writers and they're not editors and they're not supposed to be. So I have to take that material, raw material, some of it is more raw than others, and make it readable so that the average member out there who is chasing cars down the line can figure it out without having to feel like they're working to figure it out. But a lot of times you're just chasing people. I'm working on a manual right now on how to write letters to the editor, letters to your congressperson, and press releases and articles. And one of the definitions of deadline in there is that a deadline is a figment of the editor's imagination. Because nobody's going to respect it except you. But a lot of times you spend just chasing down the right people to get the information from them so that you can put the paper together. And then the day after the paper's already been printed, they come in and say, well, I need this in now. You know, you're going to get it next week. You're not going to get it this week. Or you're going to have to do a separate. I guess that's the most frustrating thing about it. The most rewarding thing about it is that I do get to slant the news in a direction that's positive for the union and for the membership. By that, I mean, okay, you could just put in a blurb that the old Newsboys raised $2,033.95. Or you could go on and say how our membership has continued to give and give and give to all these different charities, even though we've been going through some hard times of our own for the last 3 years. You kind of control the message and present it. I've always maintained, even back when Gary Bernath was president, it was we need internal communications, which is our newsletter and our website, and we also need external communications to the public. I think we've got a good grasp on promoting the union to our own membership. And that's one of the unexpected side effects of this plant closure, is that it's opened up a lot of educational opportunities for members who weren't and may never be activists, but at least now they're knowledgeable about what the union does or is supposed to do or is trying to do. And I think most of them can see, because of the different programs that were put into effect, like the layoff support team and the human resource group, they can see that our union did something that the other unions weren't doing.
Doreen Howard.
What do you do as the recording secretary? What is your duties in that position?
As recording secretary, I take the minutes at the executive board meeting and at the general membership meeting, and also responsible for attendance. There are some members that are appointed to positions, be it a local appointment or what they call a DOC 46 or international appointment, are required to attend one out of every 3 meetings minimum. And so it's my responsibility to keep track of that. They sign in. I let the hall secretary know. If they've missed 3 meetings in a row, they're sent a letter saying you can be removed from your position. That gives them one more meeting to come to, and ask to be excused. And some of them get excused for the damnedest reasons. I don't know. I don't want to lose my job. Okay, you're excused. you know, that's... And then I've seen it go the other way around where people have kind of a valid excuse and they're rejected as just whatever the membership action dictates is what happens. On the meeting day, I do those, and I take my minutes, I compose at the computer, so I take the minutes on laptop, and then as soon as I get time, I go through them, and I kind of do a typing shorthand thing, and so I've got to go in and fill out all my abbreviations and all that. Then it goes on to the hall computer. The secretary, the president's secretary, reviews it, proofreads it, formats it, and prints it out so that it can be distributed at the next meeting. Same thing with the attendance. This role, I think, is a little more activist than what maybe some of our previous secretaries have. Or maybe it's just that I've been lucky. To be counted among this administration, at least, be counted among the leadership. Past administrations, from what I've seen, the recording secretary's role was kind of a backgrounder thing, somebody that worked from the sidelines, and feel like I've been given a lot of opportunities to take some leadership roles, as in the layoff projects, that you wouldn't normally see in the past. But I think because of the demands on our union these days, that we need more people in leadership roles, and that's a contributing factor. I'm not trying to say I deserve to be a leader. I'm saying we just need more leaders. We need more people to share the responsibilities so that, I'm horribly concerned that or Steve, either one, are going to get burned out and end up in the hospital sick or something because they're literally wearing themselves out. And so it's good to see so many other people taking leadership roles and getting their ideas going, and I think it makes them feel empowered and more a part of the union. If you're not a part of the solution, then you're part of the problem.
Donna Jean, I'm sorry, Cheryl McCoy, you mentioned that your husband works in the plant. Was that a shop romance? Did you meet him at work?
I met him at a union meeting. I came, as I said, to Fisher Body in August of 94. I was in October, I had my whatever time in, 90 days, is that 90 days in? And I went to the October union meeting because I was officially part of the union now. Up until that point, you were just kind of like, yeah, you are, but not, you don't have full rights or whatever.
That's true.
To representation. So in October, I went to the first union meeting, and Gary Bernath swore me in. And I had felt compelled to thank the membership for helping. This local helped a lot of us who had been laid off for the long periods of time. We'd broke seniority. Apparently, there was some move on management's part to hire off the street, and this local was instrumental in saying, no, first we bring back all our people that are laid off. Mm-hmm. So I thanked the membership after I was sworn in for doing that, for being willing to step up the bat and risk going out on strike if necessary to do that. So then on my way back down the center aisle, there was two gentlemen on my right. One of them was Derek Quinney. He was right on the aisle. And the next one was Pete Gillespie. And the people were shaking my hand as I walked down, welcoming me to the local. And Derek reached out to shake my hand, and Pete just about knocked him over to get to me. So I knew right then. That boy's serious. Yeah. No, I actually, it wasn't until probably December Christmas party that same year, 94. And I was talking to this couple that I had no clue who they were. I still don't. But they said they got married here at the Union Hall, and they had their reception here. And I thought that was really, really cool. And I still, at this point, I knew Pete. I talked to him every day, but we hadn't dated or anything. And I finished talking to that couple, and I walked up to the front of the club room part, and Pete was sitting there with Andy Graham and Michelle Penfield, and I put my hand on his shoulder, and I said, "Well, Petey, how are you?" And I thought, and he looked up at me, and I just knew right then, you know, we're going to get married here in this Union Hall.
And how many years later did that happen?
10 years later, 2005. That was 94. He didn't actually ask me out until February of 95. And so it took 10 years, but yeah, I kind of grew on him.
You had a very interesting wedding here, didn't you? Have a very
interesting wedding party. We did. Want to tell us a little bit about that? It was great. I loved it. We'd both been married previously. We didn't want people to... We wanted friends and family there, but we didn't want them to feel like it was something big, formal, and bring an expensive gift. So the first thing we did was we sent out flyers instead of invitations. And the flyers had our dog on it. And our dog was dressed in a nice tuxedo, and he's going to be... Actually, he was one of the bridesmaids, but he wore a tuxedo because we couldn't find a gown to fit him. And the flyers also asked that instead of wedding gifts, that people bring food or money to donate to the Lansing Food Bank. And we weren't going to have a band. We were going to hire a comedian. We got that taken care of, and then a band volunteered anyway from our church. So it ended up being a lot of fun, a lot of people, potluck kind of thing. Lots of people brought lots of food, and the dog had a wonderful time. In fact, one of the nicest things, coming down the aisle, my daughter had the dog. She was behind Pete and I as we went down the aisle, and somebody stopped, and they had a little gift bag of dog treats for the dog. I thought that was so sweet. He just stayed there forever until all the treats were gone. But anyway, we had a great time. We had a good party. It was great. And we raised around $1,000 for charity. Yeah. Not counting the food that was donated to.
Lorraine Howard.
Going back to the different plants that you were at, what were the working conditions like at our facility compared to the working conditions that you were at or you saw at the other plants? And of those, what made us different, I guess, than other facilities?
You can't say that it was the plant that was different. Actually, the other facilities looked newer. They had better lighting, natural lighting. I always thought Fisher Body was hotter than any of the other plants that I worked in. I think the difference has to be the people. And nothing wrong with anybody I ever worked with. I loved them all and I harassed them all. But the people here at this plant worked in some unbelievably negative conditions. I remember one spring, we literally had to wade through water to get to our jobs. It was like swimming pools. The plant was so flooded, and yet they didn't shut her down. They kept the line running there. You know, the working conditions themselves, I think, are actually worse here than they were at the other two plants I saw.
Marilyn Coulter.
Coming in here, as some plants they do, were there any types of pranks that were played? How did people pass the time? What types of things did you do for lunches and holidays?
I don't remember the potlucks like they had at Fisher Body. Honestly, God, I don't remember having any potlucks at Chassis, but they probably did. I just don't remember them because it was so long ago. But it seemed like here, there's always some kind of potluck or some kind of fundraiser for the needy or something always going on, and a lot of times it involved food. whenever possible, I'd say. Seemed to be a prerequisite. We'll do something as long as there's food, and food is a good way to get people to participate.
Do you have any other family members other than your husband that work here?
Yes, I do. My sister Diane Houston is in charge of the Skill Center. And she and I actually hired in at Chassis in 81. And 2 weeks later, she hired in here at Fisher Body. I got laid off. She stayed. So she actually has 7 years more seniority than I do, even though we basically got hired in at the same time. It was just kind of luck of the draw because she's been laid off over the years, but she was never laid off long enough to break seniority. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, Cheryl McCoy, did you mention any of the pranks or any of the horseplay? Did you see any of that?
That I can tell you about?
Can you tell me about anything?
Mostly I saw like glove ball fights, you know, or somebody would get up and you'd hide something on them. Somebody would go to the bathroom and then they'd look for the lunch pail, but it wouldn't be where they thought it was. But I never saw any. One time, they had this thing, and I can't remember. Mary Malusik, remember her?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they had this thing where they went around and they outlined everything in yellow tape, where the trash bins were supposed to go and where the stock, platforms were supposed to go. Everything was outlined in yellow tape on the floor. So one day when our supervisor was gone to a meeting and the line broke down, we found a roll of yellow tape and we went in and we put little corner yellow tape on his legs of his desk on the floor, and then we put around the four prongs of his little swivel chair and then just waited for him to notice. We just went in his office and did all that. I mean, that was a harmless prank. It, yeah, maybe wasted 2 yards of tape, but and then he never noticed it until he went over. He's so used to seeing yellow tape all over. He never noticed it until he bent over to tie his shoe. And here's these yellow tapes where he's supposed to just stay right there. But other than that, it's all mostly harmless. And, you know, if somebody go do something, then other people would set them up or send notes down the line, jokes down the line. I didn't really see any horseplay that would endanger anybody's safety.
Mm-hmm.
Not at any of these plants.
Marilyn Coulter, what made a good supervisor? What made a bad supervisor?
You know, that's such an interesting question because I've seen management that were pure management. They'd never worked on the line. And I've seen them that are good that have been good supervisors, what I call a good supervisor. Likewise, I've seen supervisors that came from the line and should know what the line is like that weren't good, in my book, good supervisors. So it's a mix. I don't think it's what your values are. And some supervisors, long before all these new support the operator things, they already knew what their job was. And their job was to be there if you needed help and to get out of your way and let you do your job the rest of the time. And they did that. Manuel Garza was a good one like that. And by the same token, I can name a couple of supervisors that came from the line that weren't. All of a sudden, they had this management code. They treated their employees like they were real people, just maybe not close personal friends, but working. It was a working relationship instead of a supervisor-worker relationship. It's like kind of, well, we're all into this together. And I've worked with supervisors just, you know, like straight out of school. And I think it's a difference in personality, not necessarily in your background or your training, your personal values.
Now, one thing also. Now, I know when they came in here, I know they had the smoking was mm-hmm. allowed, and then the smoking ban happened. Mm-hmm. How did that affect you and your coworkers?
Well, we got outside more. A lot of people didn't like it. A lot of people, I'm sure that it helped all of us in that we learned to go for at least an hour and a half till the next break without a cigarette, but it's very difficult when you only have 12 minutes or 14 minutes for a break to go to the bathroom, run outside for a cigarette, and if you have to heat your lunch up or whatever, you know, a snack or something, it's pretty consuming. It would have been better if they had had smoking stations that were not a half a mile away, you know, within walking distance, but I'm a smoker and I think I'm in a, excuse the pun, dying breed. Okay. And I think it's probably good that the new plant is non-smoking. A lot of your more seniority people are going to resent that and probably find ways to cheat. But in the long run, if I can work all in here for 4 hours at a stretch and not have a cigarette, I can work. You know, I can make it work, and if I can make it work, anybody can. Because I'm basically lazy and greedy.
Doreen Howard.
What is one of your happiest or saddest times in the plant?
In the plant. I don't know. I just don't really think I want to go there.
Okay, Marilyn Coulter, is there anything that you'd like to talk about that we haven't talked about?
One reward, unexpected benefit of being involved in so many union activities, and especially like the layoff support programs and things like that, is I got to meet so many people in the last couple of years that I never would have gotten an opportunity to meet otherwise, because when you work in paint shop, when you work in trim, you don't get to circulate with the people in paint shop because it's an isolated environment. You don't see the people in body shop, very many of them, because that's another isolated environment even further away. You basically, if you're a trimmer, you know most of the people in trim, and that's kind of your world there. But being involved in these other projects got me around. And Lord help me, I'm old and I can't remember names very well. So, but people who met me when I was doing interviews, layoff interviews, they remember me. And so I say, hi, hon, how you doing? Or, hi, sweetie. You know, I try to fake it until I'll remember their name, but usually not right at first glance. But I think that was the benefit of this whole thing, is I got to meet so many people. The saddest time, I do have a sad one. Can we back up to that?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
At the end of the first wave of layoffs, the very last night, we went around with the fresh packets of material to make sure everybody had all the newest, latest, greatest material, the fact sheets and all that. And I walked the entire trim shop and talked to every single person that I had worked with during the last 6 to 8 weeks on getting them their information. And I got right to the end, which was the repair line, the end of C-trim. And those guys weren't going anywhere, so I knew I didn't have to talk to them. So then I cried all the way back. Because you get so tight with these people, and you knew that you were never going to know the end of some of these stories. And being a writer and an avid reader, I always read the end first. I like to know where the story's going. I like to know that the one kid who had a baby on the way and his insurance was only going to last a month after the baby, you know. I want to know that these kids all came through safe, and we really had no way to follow up on that. Once they were out of the plant, we did, you know, we made meetings available, informational meetings available on a weekly basis, kind of a coffee hour for anybody to have questions, and some of them did show up. But they go away. And until we're all back together at the new plant, you don't know how they made out. One of the concerns the human resource group had was how many deaths, how many suicides, how many cancer or other stress-related illnesses are going to come out of this, how many divorces and broken homes. And those were things that we considered every time we met, every week. And ways, there's a limit to what we can do, but we can make sure that they have access to resources that can help them with those problems. But you never know until we all end up back at the new plant how some of those stories ended. And hopefully they didn't end. They just continue on to the next step. But anyway, I cried all the way back. That was sad. But I made it. I made it to the end of the line before I started. By the time I got back up to the office, I couldn't breathe.
Thank you. Thank you for the interview. Thank you for the things we've done. We didn't know.
Thank you.
Thanks. I didn't know you didn't know.